The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Brack, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from Our State magazine. Today's reading of Our State is underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving the community since 1974 and underwriting our podcast for over 15 years. They can be reached at 919-781-1973. Welcome back to the last reading from the July 2023 edition of Our State magazine, celebrating North Carolina. Our theme this month has been A Taste of Summer. We're going to talk some more about rock and roll today with an article entitled Starstruck. Some of the biggest names in rock and roll have taken a break from the stage while traveling through North Carolina. Hitting the streets of cities like Charlotte and the winding country roads of the Blue Ridge Mountains to explore and mingle with locals. Written by Eddie Huffman. They arrived in station wagons and tour buses, limousines and private jets. They crisscrossed North Carolina, sporting piled-up pompadours and flowing manes. They wrestled guitars and pounded drums, combining catchy riffs with a beat that dragged you out of your chair. They antagonized parents, teachers, and preachers, and inspired teenagers to dress down and act up. They created a glorious cacophony that, during the second half of the 20th century, held much of the world in sway. And once in a while, they came down from Mount Olympus, or the Colosseum stage at least, and showed up in the real world. When Mick Jagger posed with a beer at the Thirsty Beaver Saloon in Charlotte for an Instagram photo the night before a Rolling Stones concert in September 2021, it was just the latest in a long line of memorable rock star sightings in the Tar Heel State. Rockers have entertained North Carolinians since the genre's infancy. Some stayed in luxury hotel suites, while others faced the dreadful realities of Jim Crow-era segregation and had to get creative with their accommodations. Stars like James Brown, Ray Charles, and Ike and Tina Turner took advantage of Green Book-listed sites. Reginald Hodges grew up around the corner from one, the Magnolia Hotel in Greensboro. When he was a kid, he marveled at the sight of black celebrities pulling up in chauffeur-driven vehicles. Fats Domino avoided Jim Crow restrictions by traveling with his own lodgings. In an interview in the 1990s, the late North Carolina historian David Southern recalled Domino rolling into Burlington in the 50s with a fleet of pink Airstream trailers, each one with FD painted on the side. And there are more. Here's a look at five historic sightings of rock stars in the wild in North Carolina. Elvis has left the Roadhouse. Burlington. Elvis Presley wowed the packed house at Walter M. Williams High School Auditorium in Burlington on the evening of February 15, 1956, combining a high-energy performance with an audacious appearance. He sported a greasy ducktail hairstyle, pleated pants, propped collar, or rather a popped collar, and dirty bucks on his feet. Burlington resident Ramona Glenn, who attended the concert, became a lifelong fan that night, even if she thought his hip-swiveling stage moves were kinda trashy. After the concert, Elvis and his crew loaded up their gear and headed west on U.S. Highway 70, one of the primary east-west routes through North Carolina in the 1950s. They drove past dark Piedmont farms and fields until they spotted the welcoming lights of the Brightwood Inn, a red brick roadhouse on the eastern edge of Guilford County. The future king of rock and roll was on his first jaunt through North Carolina during his inexorable rise to fame in the mid-50s. His tour included appearances at L. Coon High School in Wilson, the National Theater in Greensboro, and 5 weeks after his 21st birthday, his memorable stop in Burlington and his visit to the Brightwood Inn. Decades later, the waitress who served him recalled exactly what he ordered, a hamburger with lettuce and tomato and a glass of milk. The Brightwood later turned the booth where he ate into an Elvis shrine. Well, he was good-looking, waitress Lucille Little told the Greensboro News and Record in 1999, but I can't say he was the best-looking. I've seen a lot of handsome guys. And in Flat Rock, knock, knock, knocking on Sandberg's door. Bob Dylan and some friends were driving a new Ford station wagon through the winding mountain roads around Flat Rock in 1964, looking for one of the singer's heroes. They were more than 600 miles from New York City's Greenwich Village and not sure exactly where they were going, according to Dylan's biographer, Anthony Scaduto. It was February, and the trees were still bare. Dylan, 22, hopped out at a gas station and addressed a lanky man in overalls. "Where's Carl Sandburg's place? You know, the poet." "You mean Sandberg the goat farmer?" Sandberg's wife, Lillian Paula Sandberg, had made her own mark as an award-winning goat farmer. "No, I mean Sandberg the poet," Dylan said. "Don't know about no poet. There's a Sandberg, has a goat farm. Wrote a book on Lincoln. Little guy, littler than you even. If that's the one, take the road 2 miles up there. Turn left after the little bridge. Can't miss it if you're sober." Dylan had not yet gone full-on electric rock and roll, but the young folk singer had already established himself as the voice of his generation with songs like "Blowin' in the Wind." He and his friends had headed south just days before the Beatles landed in Dylan's adopted hometown of New York for their historic appearance on the Ed Sullivan Show. Dylan had a show to play at Emory University in Atlanta, but he made a detour through the Blue Ridge Mountains. He found Sandberg at the poet's White House on a hill called Connemara. Established and originally named Rock Hill by the first treasurer of the Confederate States of America, Sandberg and his acolyte had a friendly 10-minute chat, though the singer's friends said that he seemed miffed that the venerated poet didn't recognize him. Dylan left Sandberg with a copy of his latest album, "The Times They Are A-Changin'." Greensboro, a barrel of monkeys, and a guitar god. Trevor Brackett shimmied into a shift dress, zipped up her white go-go boots, and left her house in Greensboro's Dogwood Forest. It was the kind of post-war suburb that the Monkees sang about in their brand-new single, Pleasant Valley Sunday, with charcoal burning everywhere. The date was Wednesday, July 12, 1967, and school had been out for weeks. Trevor rode with her friend Sally Birdsong to the Oaks Motel on Summit Avenue. Sally was president of the Gate City chapter of the Monkees Fan Club. Trevor was vice president. Neither girl had turned 16 yet, so they had to get an older relative to drive them. A couple of skinny guys swam in the motel pool. Their hair was longer than most people in Greensboro had ever seen on men. Police officers standing guard to keep the Monkees' teenage fans at bay made rude comments, questioning the swimmers' masculinity. But the swimmers weren't Monkees. They were young Englishmen who played with a flamboyant guitarist who was opening for the Monkees that night, Jimi Hendrix. The Monkees were the original manufactured boy band, assembled by Hollywood producers to sing a song or two and goof around on TV for half an hour each week. But they chafed at their image as rock and roll poseurs for teeny boppers and learned to respect in the serious rock of scene of the mid-1960s. They enlisted an unlikely band as the opening act for their summer tour, the Jimi Hendrix Experience, a provocative psychedelic rock trio from England led by an American expatriate. Hendrix's group had just made its stateside debut at the Monterey Pop Festival in California. There, he'd wowed fans and critics alike with his audacious guitar playing and an outrageous performance that culminated in him burning his guitar on stage. Trevor had trouble meeting all the Monkees, despite her position in the fan club, but she did get an autograph from Mickey Dolenz, who sang and played drums for the group. Then she sheepishly knocked on the door of Hendrix's room, finding him inside playing an acoustic guitar left-handed. She told him that her English pen pal had said that he was really cool and that she just wanted to say hello. "He grunted at me," she remembers, "like, 'What are you doing here, you little kid?'" At the Greensboro Coliseum that night, Hendrix lived up to his ostentatious image. He comes on stage, and he's got this fop outfit with the big sleeves and the puffy stuff, a purple jacket, very flamboyant and loud, Trevor says. I remember standing up going, "Yes, yes!" All these people are like, "Who is this man who's up there being naughty?" He played Foxy Lady, which was my favorite at the time. Everybody thought I was out of my mind, but I was told that he was cool, and I was gonna make sure that somebody liked him. Hendrix opened for the Monkees in Charlotte the next night, too, but dropped off the tour after only 7 shows, fed up with the hostile reception that his music was getting from most of the Monkees' teeny bopper fans. Now in Chapel Hill, something to talk about. As Bonnie Raitt walked along the sidewalk in Chapel Hill, she saw and heard something unusual, even by the college town's freewheeling standards in 1973. A group of musicians were in the bed of a single cab Volkswagen pickup truck parked in front of the record bar on Henderson Street, playing and singing a song that was very familiar to her, "Taken My Time," by the blues singer Spider John Kerner. "I remember she started smiling and cocked her head and kept walking toward us," says Bland Simpson, who sang and played a compact rehearsal piano in the truck. "And then she just started laughing and shaking her head and saying, 'I haven't heard that song in way too long.'" Raitt had named her latest album for the song, and she was in town to promote it. When Simpson and 2 of his friends in the Southern States Fidelity Choir got wind of that she was coming, they decided to give a memorable welcome to one of their favorite singers. Raitt was scheduled to sign albums at the record shop in the afternoon before her show at Memorial Hall on the University of North Carolina campus. Another Raitt fan, UNC sophomore Marvin Vito, had brought his camera downtown and captured the whole encounter on film. "I wasn't sure if Bonnie knew who her serenaders were," he recalls, "but she was visibly blown away by the reception. And in Durham, a material girl in training. The summer sun lit up the colorful tights worn by a group of young dancers rehearsing outdoors on Duke University's East Campus in June of 1978. Richard Mascal, an arts reporter for the Charlotte Observer, had just arrived from the Queen City to do a story on the American Dance Festival's first year in Durham. There were all these dancers milling about, so I looked for a person to kind of hang the story on, Mascal remembers. I was struck by this young woman who was very beautiful. Not only that, but she had really had a presence. Something about her stood out, like she really knew who she was. The young woman had traveled south from Michigan to study at the ADF, and she would turn 20 in a few weeks. Her name is Madonna Ciccone. I'm sorry, but I don't know how to pronounce Madonna's real last name, C-I-C-C-O-N-E. And her face matches her name, Mascal wrote. Round eyes, arched eyebrows, finely drawn mouth, Da Vinci would have loved it. And she has a dancer's body, thin as a blade, lithe and agile. Doll-like, she looks as if she'd snap in a strong wind. She wouldn't. 5 years later, unbeknownst to anyone at the time, the MTV hits Holiday, Borderline, and Lucky Star would launch Madonna to superstardom. She was a little bit self-possessed, Mascal recalls. She wasn't gushy. I was really struck by that. I had no idea that she had aspirations to be a singer, but I was not totally surprised when she became a star. And now, jumping at the juke joint. They didn't look like much from the outside, but across North Carolina, general stores and barns and even cabins were the place to be when the jukebox started playing. Written by Billy Warden. The teenagers slipped out of the pickup truck and into the smoky adult world of dancing, gambling, and carousing. Arthur Dove II had a job to do, and it wasn't to party. Dove, known then as Bubba, and his partner had traversed dirt roads, slicing through soybean fields and pine forests to a glorified shack, one of countless juke joints that once lit up North Carolina's countryside like a constellation of stars, fueled by music, mischief, and moonshine. The job of Dove and his partner on such afternoons in the 1960s was to collect the weekly jukebox take and freshen up the selection of records that kept customers depositing nickels, dimes, and quarters into the machine. Stretching back to the 1800s, but taking off between the world wars, juke joints were quasi-clandestine clubhouses where sharecroppers, factory hands, and other rural working people would gather to cut loose, pony, and twist, raise a toast. They were deep down in the country, one road in, one road out, Dove reminisces now, with rumbly affection for those raucous times. Some were part of a regular home, some were like little cafes, some were little shacks. You could get fried chicken, barbecue, you could play cards, you could get corn grain liquor, that bootleg liquor, moonshine, 50 cents a drink in a little Dixie cup. Libations were a primary draw, but shrewd juke joint operators mostly operated without liquor licenses or other official papers, though perhaps not without certain relationships with law enforcement. The other draw was music, sometimes supplied by a band, but most often pumping from a jukebox. From classic hits to the latest sensations that you might otherwise have to strain to hear on a fuzzy radio. From pounding, jumped-up jive to sweet, swaying ballads. In the Jim Crow era, Juke joints provided black Southerners in the country with the kind of communal entertainment that was readily available to whites. And in the 1950s and 60s, these places helped ensure that everyone could experience the musical revolution and sense of liberation that pulsed through rock and roll and rhythm and blues. Dove was familiar with dozens of these hard-scrabble haunts. From the 60s to the 80s, he worked for his legendary grandfather and namesake, Arthur Dove. "You couldn't run any game on him," the younger Dove says now, 40 years after his grandfather's death, "because there was no game that he hadn't seen or tried himself." Born in Richmond County, the elder Dove landed in Raleigh in the 1930s with a fat wad of cash amassed during a stint in the Merchant Marines. For reasons unknown to his grandson, Dove plowed his savings into jukeboxes. Within a couple of decades, the smooth-talking man who was partial to dark suits and beech nut chewing tobacco supplied as many as 120 juke joints throughout central North Carolina. That vast number kept the younger Dove and his partner, who always packed a pistol in the pocket of his wide trousers in case of trouble, busy collecting coins and stocking the latest sounds. "When I restocked, I'd always play a few of the new records for free. Jackie Wilson, James Brown, Betty Wright, Aretha Franklin," says Dove, now 70. "The first time I played Otis Redding doing Try a Little Tenderness, that blew people away." There's a photo at the top of the page, which is kind of interesting. It says, "One of the biggest worries of juke joint owners wasn't necessarily breaking the law. It was running afoul of the local sheriff." And I guess I'd have to say, if you have a mental image of a local sheriff from the 1940s or whatever, heavy set, wearing a white shirt, glasses, and a hat, with two cronies behind him smoking cigars and holding flashlights, here's this guy tacking a notice up on the door of some juke joint. The juke joints weren't fancy, but they were, in their way, fantastical. Not marvels of architecture or decor, but nonetheless iconic. Like a song you can't forget, juke joints have endured in memory, calling the adventurous to travel to them through night-cloaked fields and into cricket-chirping forests to have the time of their lives. What juke joints lacked in polish, they made up for in personality. Their names were legendary. Bucket of Blood, that was a place way out in the woods near Terracotta neighborhood of Greensboro. Veteran blues and R&B bandleader Roy Roberts recalls with a shudder. "People really poured in there, but I had to cut it loose. Man, if anybody got hurt there, nobody went to check it out until daylight. That included the police." Meanwhile, 130 miles away, Brad Thompson, coming of age in Lumberton, ventured to a hole in the wall to dance the night away. It was a cinder block building with a cement floor, sometimes with sawdust on the floor, Thompson recalls. "And out in Proctorville, there was a place called Burnt Island. Anything could go on. It was an island unto itself. You weren't bound by the land laws." Still, there were limits, often enforced by larger-than-life proprietors like Horace Chambers Rutherford, who founded Roseland Gardens around 1918 in Black Mountain. In a 2006 interview, his late granddaughter, Catherine DeBrow, recalled Rutherford striding his hillside juke joint parking lot, or rather packing, two .45 caliber revolvers as a way of controlling riffraff. DeBrow also noted that Rutherford had been good friends with a longtime sheriff. For any entrepreneur seeking a prosperous career in juke joints, relations with local authorities were critical. The trick was to allow customers to blow off steam without setting off alarm bells at town hall. I've been told that the sheriff back then ran things his way, amateur historian Don Talley says of Roseland Gardens' likely arrangements with the law. And if you ran things his way, you had no problems. I'm sure that he and Mr. Rutherford had an arrangement in which the sheriff said, I don't want to have to come out here. And Mr. Rutherford said, you won't have to. Like many of its peers, Roseland Gardens featured live bands alongside its jukebox. Unlike most others, it broadened its scope to include a rather improbable audience, kids. Rutherford bought a used movie projector and offered matinees of Roy Rogers and The Phantom during evenings and on Saturday mornings. The projector now resides in the Swannanoa Valley Museum and History Center. Roseland Gardens' appeal also extended across racial lines. White neighbors were a common sight, according to Rutherford's granddaughter. They came to listen to the music, DeBro said. This was probably about the only place around that anybody could come and sit down in the afternoon and get a cold beer. But integration seems not to have been the norm. Dove Music supplied mostly clubs catering to black audiences, while a white-owned operator served the rest. Raleigh's Cabin by the Lake, on the city's thickly wooded western edge, was a mostly white destination, until scandals and violence in 1957 led to a fatal trouble, or for the infamous hot spot. Dove strove to stay a swift step ahead of legal entanglements. When a joint got busted, they'd padlock it, his grandson says. But everyone knew my granddaddy, so they'd give him a heads up, and he'd call us to go get the jukebox before they padlocked it inside. Occasional busts notwithstanding, the juke joint business was jumping. In the mid-60s, Dove's jukebox coins and other incomes were bringing in $100,000 a year, the equivalent to almost $1 million today. Dove's other enterprises included a Negro League baseball team called the Raleigh Tigers and a mortician's license. But he wasn't burying anyone, says his grandson. He was using the coffins to run corn liquor. Of course, as with any party, the fizzle was inevitable. Arthur Dove, who had been known for decades to friends and associates as Old Man Dove, died in 1983 at age 90. By then, juke joints were on their way out, too. Roseland Gardens hosted its last batch in 1976. Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of Our State Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and that you'll be sure to listen next time. I'm Fred Brack, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's reading of Our State Magazine was underwritten by the Carter Glass Insurance Agency, serving our community since 1974. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Our State Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call the studios, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.